The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is episode 40 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake. All the way from Cranston, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's chat with Damon Lindelof and Tom Perata. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. And your friends won't come. So show me where you fit. So show me where you fit. Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and I'm so happy to be back for season three. I'm ready, baby.
Amen.
I'm done. I'm cooked. That's it. I'm ready to go.
You know, there is so much amazing television that The Leftovers has created, and it's only been two seasons, and of course, we only have one left, and it is a show that we could rewatch and talk about and discuss for a very long time.
Right.
Henceforth, why we do this podcast. So, yeah, I mean, I'm ready. I'm just as you are.
I will admit, though, that I am a little sad that it is only 8 episodes coming this season.
Little sad?
Yeah, a little sad about it. I'm not going to lie.
A lot sad?
Well, yeah, a lot sad. But, you know, I do trust Damon and Tom to make the correct decision on how many episodes they have left to tell for The Leftovers. And if there's anything in this world that I hate more than anything, it's fluff in television. I don't want filler. Filler sucks. Mm-hmm. And I got a feeling that we're going to have very little filler. And I trust that Damon and Tom won't do that. As a matter of fact, I think we're going to get right down to the meat of it immediately.
Good.
And I'm very excited about that.
Me too.
So this is our 40th episode of The Living Reminders. And what a way to ring in the 40th episode of The Living Reminders than to chat with Damon Lindelof and Tom Perata,
the creators of this show,
at the same time. As a matter of fact, I don't think that they have appeared together on a podcast at all. And, you know, obviously they have appeared together in some form or fashion in like these big venues, but nothing as intimate like this directly into a consumer's ear like you're getting right now with our podcast. And I am so honored by this. And they had some really great stuff to say, especially as it relates to season one and season two. Mm-hmm. And they even go into a little bit of season three as well. And so the whole idea behind this episode was to do a retrospective on seasons one and two, and to get a little bit more intimate with Tom and Damon about what they felt about seasons one and two, their favorite parts, what they wish they could have done over, or wish what they wish they could really expand upon. And we kind of get into that with them. And I thought it was a great conversation.
I agree. I mean, it's so fun when we get to interview someone, but when you get to interview two people who work together on a project that you love, you almost get to stand back and be a little fly on the wall.
Right.
Because this is types of conversations that they might have been having anyway between themselves.
Yeah, just like right in the writer's room. They were probably just talking back and forth. And, you know, to be honest, that's kind of what we let them do. We let them go back and forth with each other. And the admiration that they have for the both of each other is through the roof. And you can sense it even through the headphones or through your car stereo that you might be listening to this through. So, you know what, my love, why don't we just stop wasting everybody's time and like,
Get into the reason why we're here. Great idea.
All right, so let's do it.
The The gentlemen joining us today need no introduction, obviously. They are the creators behind what we believe to be the best show on television. So, Damon and Tom, thank you so much for joining us once again on this extra special episode of The Living Reminders today.
It is an honor to be here.
Yeah, we're very happy to be here. Thanks so much for all your support of The Leftovers over these years. It's meant a lot to us.
Of course. Well, Damon, we're going to first start with you, and we want to know what first drew you to this project in adapting Tom's book to the screen.
I've actually been a fan of Tom's for quite some time now. Election was the first piece of writing of his that I was exposed to, and I just thought it was phenomenal, like everybody else, and sort of kept my eyes peeled and my ears open for whatever would come next. And then, and of course, Little Children, Abstinence Teacher, a number of his short stories, all of which I read, and I was just a big Parada fan. And then what happened was there was a New York Times book review of The Leftovers that was written by Stephen King. And I'm a huge Stephen King fan as well. And in the opening paragraph of Stephen King's review of The Leftovers, he made some allusion to the fact that it was the best episode of The Twilight Zone that had never been produced, and then went on to sort of explain the premise of the departure. And I just remember feeling that thing that you feel inside yourself as, you know, not just a writer, but as a human, where I just got completely and totally, I felt like someone had just plugged me in. That in the Venn diagram of things that I loved, Tom's writing, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, here it was all for the taking. So I was in an airport at the time that I read that book review. And so I immediately bought the hardcover of The Leftovers and read it, and was just deeply emotionally affected by it. I just thought it was a beautiful book. And I was reading it at a time where Lost had been over for almost a year at that point, I think. I don't know when it aired, but it felt like there'd been a period of many months when that was behind me. And I was still processing the ending of that show, but more importantly, the burden of the mysteries on that show, and how excruciatingly stressful it was to answer those mysteries with some level of satisfaction for the audience. And here was Tom's book sort of unapologetically saying, I have no interest whatsoever in mystery. I'm more interested in people's response to not getting the answer and what the hell they're supposed to do now. And it just lit me up. So I reached out to my agents about what was going on with the book, and learned that Tom had already set it up at HBO, and did everything that I could to lobby for a meeting with Tom, so that I could tell him that I thought his book was amazing. It would make a pretty cool TV show. Mm-hmm. I was made aware that I wasn't the only one out there vying for this opportunity. And I was lucky enough to get Tom's attention. And of course, we fell deeply in love after that. And the rest is history.
Well, you know, let me just add to that. And that's very sweet, Damon, that I had sort of missed. My kids were young. I just had sort of missed Lost. And I started watching it maybe, you know, before it had ended. But, you know, I was way behind. I was watching on DVDs with my son, and I was just stunned by how good it was and how inventive the storytelling was. And so when HBO brought up Damon's, you know, we're talking about possible showrunners, and Damon's name came up, and I was literally like, you know, had just been going through this period of watching Lost and feeling like I'd never seen anything quite like this on TV, and that the writing was remarkable. So it was, you know, in that sense, a really easy match, because we had a, you know, mutual admiration going pretty strong.
Wow. At the same time, how kismet.
Yes. Now, of course we hate each other, but it is nice to reminisce.
We had a good run though.
Yeah.
You can just consider yourselves the Beatles. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine.
Sure.
So, Tom, you started off with the book that was a big event, obviously, but the story itself was relatively small, I mean, within context. So both of you guys have gone through the first season, and you're finally now outside of the source material of the book. Now you had to move on to season two. So were there any moments or scenarios within the show or writing it, you know, from the last two seasons that you were like really surprised to find any of the characters in? You know, for instance, if somebody ever described the concept of international assassin to you back when the show was greenlit and your story was headed there, would you have believed them or would you like have punched them in the face and been like, nah, no way?
No. I was definitely the frog in the boiling water, you know. Because I went in, you know, sort of determined to sort of, you know, hold the line that you know, I had it in my head, you know, The Leftovers is a realistic story. You know, it has this one supernatural event, and then it's really just people dealing with the fallout from this supernatural event. And Damon will tell you that, you know, I tried very much through the first season to hold that line. And I remember various moments when Damon was sort of hinting at the future, you know, how bearded Kevin Garvey was going to be wandering through Texas. And you know, I just thought it was some joke, but a lot of these turned out to
it's on you, sucker.
But no, of course, you know, when Damon said, I want Kevin to die this season, you know, and come back, and I'm just like, you're not going to be able to pull that off. So I think, you know, that was, I think, so many of the things that happened. I sort of feel like by season three, I think Damon will tell you, I was a willing journey. I was a willing participant in the journey. But for the first two seasons, I was a couple steps behind going, are you sure? Are you sure?
Thank God.
So do you think that was the biggest chance you guys took, killing Kevin off, or was there something that was bigger or more risky in your both of your minds that you did in seasons one or two?
Well, I got to say that's a pretty big one for me. I don't know if Damon can think of something bigger.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, I think that we felt fairly liberated when it came to the idea of risk. In a way that I feel like if The Leftovers was a gargantuan success on the level of sort of Game of Thrones or The Sopranos, that we would have been more cognitive of, oh, could we lose our entire audience if we do these ideas? The benefit of only having, based on the latest numbers, 38 people watching The Leftovers, including the four of us participating in this interview. You know, it's just sort of, if it passes a gut check, and our writer's room, and it is very difficult. It's very difficult for a bill to become a law in the writer's room. And if it does make it out of the House, it then has to go to the Senate, and that's Mimi Leader and all the actors and HBO writ large. And if it can make it past them, then it's good. But I think that was what was particularly exciting about some of the things that we started to do in season one is they didn't feel like risks, at least to me. They just felt organic to the world in which we were participating. But, you know, for me, Tom refers to the idea that the sudden departure was the one supernatural event that occurred on the show. And I contend that that is still the case. Even with episodes like International Assassin or the idea that Kevin Garvey was buried in the ground and came out of the ground and shot in the chest. And, you know, I just don't look at those in terms of the supernatural purview. And what was going to be more interesting for us as storytellers is because the departure happened, anything could be supernatural. So if there's a guy out there giving hugs and healing people, maybe he is, but I think that the people's ability to be hoodwinked and suckered into humbuggery and tomfoolery and flat out hoaxes would exponentially be increased in the world where the sudden departure occurred. That was really interesting to explore. And I think that there are stories all the time in the real world where people are dead for short periods of time, or even stories where people are interred. and come back to life that are incredible, but not supernatural. And all these people have near death experiences and, conversations with God. These are all happening in our world. But when you do those stories on The Leftovers, they take on you do get to say, is this supernatural because of the umbrella of supernaturality cast by The Departure? I think what I'm trying to say is, like, everything on that's weird on the show is Tom's fault. Yeah. even though it's attributed to me, I think that, you know, he enabled his own freak flag to fly by partnering with me. He knew that he wanted to go in this direction, and he chose a partner that would take him there.
Yes, we're codependent in this case. I think that actually, I'm convinced by that, Damon. I think, we really tried season one to always have a rational explanation for the weirdness. And what was interesting is I do think we managed to keep that up all the way through the show, you know. But what I think what I'm trying to say is the weirdness grew. Yes. To a scale that I hadn't anticipated. And, yes. and that was the thrill for me, is to see just how weird the show could get. I mean, there's a show like Twin Peaks, which I loved at the time, but it sort of lost all relation to reality at some point, where I feel like Left got extremely weird while keeping some relationship to what we all think of as reality.
We were talking about the beginning of the second season, and more importantly, like, sort of the big story arc of the second season outside of creating Miracle, which we've kind of talked about extensively. Tom Spezialy, the other Tom who came on between seasons one and seasons two, had suggested we watch this this movie, Picnic at Hanging Rock, which I had seen years before but had kind of forgotten about. And then that became the impetus for the disappearance of Evie and her two friends, the three girls departing. And from the word go, I was like, this is the perfect idea for The Leftovers, because in the real world, if we were just doing, you know, a straight up crime drama, if these girls disappear, there's only two possible explanations. Explanation number one is they're the victims of foul play. Somebody murdered them or kidnapped them. And explanation number two is they faked their disappearance, and they're on the lam. They've run off. They've ghosted. In this show, there's a third possibility, which is they went where the other 140 million people went. And that to me was like so exciting. And we very quickly said, it's not that we're going to take. It's definitely not going to be number three, but that they just disappeared and went to where everybody else went. It's going to be number two, but won't it be fun to explore the possibility of number three? What if all the characters on the show are questioning as to whether or not it was number three? And so you have Nora Durst. She's basically saying it was definitely number two. She cracked the case, you know, as early as episode four, but it's fun to watch all the other characters consider the possibility of the weirdest version of the show, mm-hmm. as long as we're doing the most normal version.
Right. And what we also did, I think, was make the DSD and that investigation a really kind of a fun part of the show, because that felt so mundane and the bureaucrat, you know, the bureaucratic response to this, you know, possible supernatural event and the questionnaire, all these items, which to me were kind of Kafkaesque, absurd, bureaucratic response to The Departure, really was both very funny and again, kept it grounded in a very interesting way. And then didn't preclude like that big emotional scene in episode six between Nora and Erica that you guys, I know you'd like to talk about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but before we do, I know we were talking about things being too weird and there being, you know, multiple levels of things having to pass like a bill would have to. Was there anything that was ever pitched that was too weird for Edson for some point?
Oh, my God. Bill, many, many, many things. many, many, many things. and we're not going to share any of them with you.
Fair enough. Well, yeah. Tom, speaking about that that scene from Lens, you know, it was amazing. The conversation between Nora and Erica, did you know it would be as well received as it was? I mean, I also remember likening it on the podcast to Hannibal and Clarice's conversations in Silence of the Lambs. Mm-hmm. So in terms of direction, was that by design, or was that like a writer's choice? Did you guys want to make sure that happened, or was that a choice of the directors?
You know, all I'll say is, you know, I love the idea of it, and I think it was a rough scene to write, as you can imagine. And I know Damon, so much of that was coming from you. Once we had it written, I thought it was going to be great, but then Craig Zobel did things with it that I wasn't prepared for. I hadn't been talking to him, so maybe Damon knows at what point that strategy for filming it, you know, came to pass. But I did think on the page that it was really powerful.
I think that when we were talking about that episode, that we knew that it was going to be a Nora Erica episode, where a lot of our episodes, as you know, are singular points of view. So essentially, we're going to tell the story, and Matt Jameson's going to be in every single scene of it, and we're telling the story through Matt's eyes. And then there are other episodes where maybe there's a couple points of view. In the premieres, we tend to cover multiple points of view. As we introduce the Murphys, but kind of you want to know who you are in the scene. So, you know, who am I supposed to be? And I remember feeling, well, this is Nora and Erica's episode. We're alternating between their points of view. They're both dealing with Evie's disappearance in different ways. Nora is being told that she is culpable in Evie's disappearance, and she's rejecting that premise. But at the same time, it's gotten under her skin. And so we knew that it was going to, I remember falling in love with the idea of, we were just going to write a long scene between these two fantastic actors, and it would be riveting just because they were so great. And it almost felt like whatever we wrote for them, they were going to elevate the material. I think we wrote the script and we were sort of like, oh, you know, we like how it turned out, but we weren't like high-fiving or feeling like we had lightning in a bottle by any stretch of the imagination. And then when I tone all the directors, that was Craig Zobel's first episode. And then he also directed International Assassin. You know, I went down to Texas and we went through the script, and you know, there are a number of scenes in Lens that required a lot of discussion in terms of the logistics of how he was going to do it. And particularly as it pertained to the big set piece, which is this, kind of town meeting, like a fundraiser that they're having for the girls, when Nora is trying to steal this file. There were just a lot of logistics involved in, you know, doing it in the visitor center, and that there was going to be a slideshow and all this stuff. And then I remember when we got to the scene between Erica and Nora, Zobel just said, "I know what to do here." And I was like, cool. If the actors have any questions about it, if Regina or Carrie have any questions about it, you know, feel free to let them reach out to Tom or I. And we kind of didn't hear anything from them. And the next thing that I remember happening is the dailies came in. And I think that was Ruscio's episode, if memory serves, episode 6. And the editor just basically said, like, wait till you see this scene. And the first time we sat in the editing room and watched it with all those incredible close-ups, and the stillness of it and the incredible level of performance, it was just like one of those amazing things that sometimes happens in TV where you're like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. That made me look like a really great writer. That's how good all these people are. It just felt like it was completely and totally cohesive. But I think that, you know, I got to give credit where credit is due, and the credit is due to Regina and Carrie and Craig.
Yeah, and I will say that there was an interesting, for me, that was one of those moments, I think, when it really became clear to me, you know, the sort of alchemy of the show, because, you know, in the opening episode of season 2, we see Erica, you know, taking this box out of the earth, and there's a dead bird inside, and it's this, it's a very strange moment. And
I know in episode one, it's a live bird.
It's a live bird. Yes, that's right.
And then in episode six, it's a dead bird.
That's correct. Yeah. So we had this weird ritual of burying the birds. And it wasn't until episode six that Erica's story, her reasoning about why she was doing it, emerged. So it was like this seed, again, these seeds got planted, and then they would, you know, flower at some later date. And that was, for me, that, you know, I didn't fully understand. When I didn't understand things as a writer, I would get nervous, you know. And, you know, what was great, I think, was learning to trust these planted seeds. That really was what season two was all about for me as a writer, was, you know, we set up these stories and we didn't always know what we were setting up. And it was, again, it was, you know, in the same way that the show is about people living with uncertainty, I was having to learn as a writer to live with uncertainty and realize that discovering meaning was what we were doing rather than sort of imposing meaning. And I think that's part of what made the show so exciting to work on and then exciting to watch.
I do have to mention just one more thing as it relates to Lens, because I do feel like it's, you know, it's the perfect antidote to explain a little bit about what Tom just said, and hearkening back to this relationship that we have with one another about feeling nervous and uncomfortable about lines that are crossed and risk, et cetera. This, you know, Lens, in my memory at least, started with me pitching some version of, and of course these episodes come together as a result of our incredible writer's room. But I remember saying, I feel, I just have this image of Nora throwing a rock through the window of the Murphy house. Cause that's really Nora Durst in a nutshell for me, is like, she's, you know, these people who have basically lost their daughter, she's mad at them because she knows that their daughter isn't where her kids are. And so that just felt like something that Nora would do. And that Tom's initial reaction to that was one, he wasn't completely embracing the idea. In fact, he was resisting it. And I was kind of trying to make a case for why I felt like this was very Nora-like and really great. And then out of nowhere, Tom just said, well, I guess I'd buy it as long as the episode ends with Erica throwing a rock through Nora's window. And I was just like, yes, yes, yes. Well, that's exactly right. And then those became the bookends of Lens. And we just kind of filled in. We had to earn those two moments. We had to earn Nora's rock throw retroactively. And we had to create a construct by which we could build to understanding what it would take for Erica to take that rock and throw it through Nora's window. And the episode was really all in service of earning those two ideas.
I'm having a good laugh because we told Carrie that we often refer to Nora as Honey Badger.
Oh.
And nice. She's like, I've heard people say that and now I know why. It's because of you guys. So that's one of my favorite Honey Badger moments, is just throwing that rock through the window, because whatever. Oh, but, you know, we've talked about a lot of signature moments on our podcast, a moment that defines the fabric of a television show. And a lot of people actually think that the conversation between Nora and Erica that we were just talking about is a signature moment for The Leftovers. So, but I wanted to ask the two of you, what do you think is The Leftovers' signature moment so far? Or have we not seen it yet?
The signature moment? I mean, oh God, I don't know if we're qualified to answer that question, because, you know, because we're writing the show. I try to think of the television shows that I love, you know, Breaking Bad or The Wire or Mad Men, and I'm overwhelmed by, you know, so many signature moments. So, I mean, to me, when it, you know, I feel like if there was one image that pops into my brain when I think about the show, it's Kevin pushing that little girl into the well. You know, when I first saw it, it just was like, what is that? You know, it was incredibly evocative. Thoreau's performance there was just off the charts. The production design, we have this amazing designer, John Pano, who did seasons 2 and 3 for us. He's doing Big Little Lies now. He built that well out in the middle of, a rock for, it was just extraordinary. And Zobel, just the way that he shot it was amazing. And so, I don't know, I think that the show has had a lot of amazing moments. I also think about Nora coming down the stairs and seeing her family of loved one mannequins, sitting around her table, and her letting out this incredible wail of pain. I think about Amy Brenneman running down members of the Guilty Remnant. I think about Matt Jameson, walking up that hill and realizing that the remnant has bought his church. Like, they so overwhelm me. But again, I can't separate myself from the process of making the show, so probably not qualified, but those are a couple.
Yeah. I've always figured like the signature moment to be like, pardon my reference, Damon, but like Kate, We Have to Go Back, or yes. I Am the One Who Knocks, or that moment at the end of, Battlestar Galactica with Starbuck. Yeah. Spoiler alert. Yeah. That always felt to me like that's something that changes a show forever that people can recognize.
Well, yeah. I mean, I make a case for John Murphy in the season 2 finale saying to Kevin, I don't understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. That moment of, John, who has really kept a tight lid on this world and his own emotions, just breaking down in the face of all these, terrible and awe-inspiring things that have happened. That felt like one of those moments.
So speaking of those moments, like, I'm not sure if either of you guys have watched Westworld yet, and it's not entirely important if you have, but a lot of fans couldn't help but speculate theories on in ways that we really haven't seen in quite some time with that show. And like, a lot of people even figured out certain twists like really early on with that particular show. So with that in mind, do you guys ever write with the fans' exploration of twists and like crowdsourcing so that they know what's coming or not?
We try not to. I mean, again, I think it's the benefit of having a show that isn't really driven by its mysteries, and where Tom has been very explicit from the word go in talking about his novel. And then when he invited me on board and we adapted the show together, we were very explicit about saying, look, there's a disclaimer on this show. If you want to know where all these people went and why them and what the sudden departure is all about, we're not, don't watch this show. We've been very upfront about it. Other shows, Lost and Westworld and Mr. Robot, very clearly invite that level of puzzle boxing, and the audience is trying to crack clues and figure things out. I think it's really interesting that in season 2 of the show, the mystery of the season was, what happened to these 3 girls? And we answered that mystery, but I feel like the audience wasn't even really interested in solving it because of the kind of show that The Leftovers is. Because if the audience had decided to figure out what happened to those 3 girls, there was data in the very first episode where they're driving alone in the car silently, or running through the woods, or singing the Miracle National Anthem, written by Mr. Tom Parada, by the way. With these kind of weird expressions on their faces that seemed to indicate that something was rotten in Denmark. But no one was like, I know what happened to those 3 girls. Because it was on the table that we might never answer it. And so it almost feels like any answer that you get on The Leftovers is one that you weren't necessarily expecting. So why go down the potential road of frustration if the storytellers are telling you this is a mystery we may never answer? And that's why I feel like these kind of zeitgeisty, like true crime podcasts and television shows like Serial or Making a Murderer, the reason that they have such resonance is, I don't know if Adnan did it. and I'm probably never going to find out. I don't know if Stephen Avery was framed, and I'm probably never going to find out. And people are still all over Reddit trying to answer those questions, but not knowing the ambiguity of that is just so much more like real life. We still don't know who assassinated John F. Kennedy, you know, people are still talking about it. It happened in 1963. And the reason that they're still talking about it is because of that ambiguity. That's the kind of storytelling that fascinates me. And I know that a lot of people revile me for being interested by that kind of storytelling, but I don't know. It's the kind of story that I love to watch and the kind of story that I love to tell.
And, you know, to me, you know, the fact that people don't really even, not even sure what questions they're asking of the leftovers there, you know, it exists in this space of radical uncertainty. You know, I think it is a truly unexpected show. I think, you know, it surprises us, and there's not really a blueprint for it. So it really is a kind of product of exploration and improvisation. And it doesn't follow these sort of genre guidelines that allow people to get ahead of it.
I love it because we podcast about it, a lot of people ask us questions about the show. And I say the same thing occasionally, like, you're asking the wrong questions. The questions that I would ask you is, who would you be? Would you be ignoring it like the teenagers in season one? Would you be in the guilty remnant? Like, those are the questions that I'm always wondering. How would I be responding to this scenario, and who would I be in this cast? So it's really interesting that that's how you both describe it, because I feel like those are the questions I tell my friends anyways. I say, ask yourself these deep questions, not just the show. Well, we would be remiss if we didn't ask about a lead in for season three. So how much of the events of season three were in your heads at the conclusion of season one, or even season two for that matter? In other words, did you have the ever famous Bible that you'd reference?
No. I mean, and, yeah. And you know, we've been very transparent about the idea that we've tried to design the leftovers one season at a time. We finished the first season and we weren't even sure whether we wanted to do a second season. And it was as the ideas began to come for season two and our excitement about those ideas that felt like it justified a reason to do it. And so we decided to do so. But then we did design the second season like another novel that had a beginning, middle, and end. And we are telling the story of Miracle and the fall of Miracle. And we were telling the story of what happened to these girls, and by way of that, what happened to the Murphy family. And we were telling the story of how Kevin basically exorcised Patty Levin once and for all. And all of those stories have had what we felt to be very satisfying conclusions at the end of season two. And it was designed that way. And then along the way, there were little breadcrumbs that we started dropping for a potential season three that might be set in Australia. We knew that when we sent Kevin Sr. off to Australia, that might be a place that the show might eventually want to go. But I think that when we finished season two, there weren't any real dangling story threads that we felt had to be dealt with. We were okay with the story ending there, but when HBO called and said, "Hey, do you guys want to do another season?" We felt like, "Yes, we do, but only if it's the last season," because it really feels like we're closer now to the end of the journey than we are to the beginning, which means that means there's one season left of storytelling. But in terms of the fundamental building blocks of the storylines of season three, all we really knew was, we can't just pretend that Kevin died and came back to life and that's not a big deal. Like, we're going to have to talk about that. Not in terms of what the cosmic relevance of it is, but what does it mean for Kevin emotionally to have had the experience that he had an international assassin, and also for the people around him who know that he quote unquote died, what do they extrapolate from that in a show that's all about trying to find meaning in things? We knew that we owed that. And so that was in the back of our minds, because we were watching Game of Thrones, of course. we knew that Jon Snow, spoiler alert, was going to come back to life. And we were sort of like, isn't that what they'd be talking about all the time? Like, you know, you can't just die and come back to life and not talk about it all the time. So we knew that that was going to be in play, but we really hadn't unpacked it until HBO offered us an opportunity to come back and do a final chapter.
I think that is absolutely right. And I think that at the time that we wrote the season two finale, we thought that image of Kevin walking in and seeing, you know, his extended family all together, and you know, him coming home after that adventure, was, you know, it would have been hard to beat as a kind of final image of a show about people losing people they loved. This reunion that had been orchestrated, I think, you know, in a really interesting way in that finale, was very powerful, and it was an interesting challenge for us to say, okay, having done that ending, if we start again, you know, what is the ultimate place that we're going, and that we won't talk about that.
Do you guys consider yourselves men of science or men of faith, and which do you think is most prevalent in The Leftovers?
Well, I'm certainly not a person of faith. So, you know, I lean toward science, but I understand that, you know, we are religious beings. You know, what, you know, that in a way it defines humanity. It's all of our history is about these systems that we've created to explain the world to ourselves, and you know, we fought wars over them, and we continue to fight wars over these systems. You know, I think The Leftovers in many ways is about the persistence of the religious impulse in an era that wants to be scientific. A little bit, it's kind of about how fragile our faith in science is. You know, this thing happens that can't be explained, and boom, we are basically no different from the cave woman.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like the most honest answer to your question is I am a man of science, but I feel much better when I'm a man of faith. And so I'm constantly trying to move towards that pole. But the gravity of science is much more powerful to me than the gravity of faith. That said, science kind of bums me out. And I'm much more, you know, if you basically like look at the world through the lens of, oh my God, everything is going to shit. That's not really a good way to lead your life, but the science does seem to support that more than everything's going to be okay. I want to spend more time and everything's going to be okay. And I don't think it's necessarily about faith in a deity, or a religious system. It's more sort of magical thinking. I mean, I guess I would say to you, you know, I'm a sports fan as well. I'm a New York Jets fan. Uh-huh. And so I have, and I know that I'm not alone in this. I will actually sometimes feel like when I'm watching a Jets game that if I turn off the television or switch channels, that the Jets will do better. And the narcissism and ego involved in that thinking that I have some impact in my living room over how the Jets are going to fare is so ridiculously shameful, but I do it anyway. I still do it. I don't have the power to not do it, even though I know scientifically that turning off the television has no consequence whatsoever in the outcome of the game. But it makes me feel better to not be watching, which tells me that I am trying to basically move into that into that faith category where I can sort of will slash pray the Jets into a just get to the playoffs, guys. Like, you can be the wild card I will settle for at this point.
Well, Damon, if it makes you feel any better, during the Super Bowl this year, I actually turned the game off. I changed my shirt off.
As a Pats fan.
And I actually shaved my beard off at halftime because I was like, I can't take this anymore. I have to do something to change the juju. So this is what we're going to do. We need to do this.
You did it. Yeah. You're the reason that the Patriots pulled it out.
Obviously. It's about time you recognize that.
Yeah. No doubt. And I hate you for that because you know how Jets fans feel about the Pats.
I do. I do. You know, I'm going to look past that minor detail just because I admire you so much. We're just going to look past that little detail.
All right. Well, the feeling is mutual. If I had known you were a Pats or Sox fan, I'm not entirely sure I would have agreed to this interview. Where are you, Mary? Are you also a Pats fan?
I am. But, you know, unlike Blake, I'm not as superstitious or hardcore about sports as he is. I'm the more logical person who then has to apologize to our guests that Blake has gone upstairs to shave his beard while we have a full house of people over. So I'm not as superstitious, but yeah, I'm a New England girl. I can't help it. Are you guys sad that your seasons together are over?
I miss Tom a lot. I mean, we've spent a tremendous amount of time together on the show, and you know, it's hard to spend that amount of time collaborating with someone whose company you really enjoy. And then suddenly you're not doing that anymore and it's over. I think that there's some level of denial emotionally for me and feeling like it's not really over until the episodes are out there and on the air. And I do get to see Tom now, you know, on this Skype call, and we're going to be doing some press, and there's going to be a little premiere here in LA that I'm going to get to see him. And so I kind of feel like our kid has basically left the house, you know, and is at college, but still comes home for Thanksgiving. So I'm not quite really empty nesting yet. And I guess I also feel like, mine and Tom's creative collaboration is not over. I think that we do have stories to tell together in the future. I don't know what form that will take, and when it will happen, but we're both still young and stupid enough to try it again, because, you know, I'm much more interested at this point in my life in who I work with and less interested in what I'm working on. And when you can find someone, you know, like Tom, who, again, I just am in awe of his talent, was before we worked together. I learned so much from him as we worked together. You know, I do feel like this was a special thing that we got to do. We got to end it on our own terms. I'm not interested really in revisiting the World of the Leftovers anytime soon, but I am interested in revisiting the world of Parada at some point, and hopefully he feels the same.
I totally do, Damon. I almost feel about the Leftovers the way I felt about college, which was, you know, I just went through this thing that really did last about 4 years, and I feel like, you know, it was a life changing thing, and I look back on it now with this incredible sense of gratitude that we did it, and you know, we did it together and with a lot of other amazing people. It just seems to be an experience that, you know, I can't find anything wrong with it.
Well, it has been such a pleasure to have the two of you on, especially hearing this. I mean, we've been able to interview lots of people, and really the mutual admiration that you guys have for each other. You can just hear it in your voices, and you've been able to see this amazing product. So I am so thankful and also so excited for your senior year to hit TV.
Yeah, party.
Senior year.
Thank you, guys, because we really do appreciate what you've done for the show. It really means a lot to us.
Yeah, and you guys have been there since the very beginning, and obviously – you know, even by our own admission, the show was not, and I wouldn't say it was like the most inviting show in terms of, you know, 5 minutes into the first episode, you're shooting dogs. it's not the easiest show to tell people that you love. But we really appreciate the level of time and attention and heart that you put into talking about it. That's genuine. I mean, again, I was born of a fan culture. I would be podcasting about a show if I wasn't fortunate enough to be writing one. And it's a big deal that you guys watch the show to the level which you do, in spite of your fandom for New England-based sports teams. I'm immensely grateful for you and everyone who takes time to listen to you talking about it.
Thank you. Well, and one more thing that I needed to let the two of you know is one of the things I often talk to Blake about the television shows that we like to watch is that so many of them, you know, really push my mind and make me think and feel in different ways, but I don't root for people all the time. That was one of the problems that I've had actually with Westworld. Is I said, I don't know who I'm rooting for, and I don't really love anybody for that. And I love that in The Leftovers, everyone is so flawed. And honestly, I don't know if I'd want to, you know, let any of them babysit my kid or anything like that. But I'm rooting for all of them. I'm rooting for every single one of them, even with all of their flaws. And I can't think of another show like that. And I think it's because you really have brought so many human attributes to the television screen. And it's been such a joy of ours, which is such a funny word to use for The Leftovers, joy. But it really has been a joy to podcast about this show.
Well, thanks. And we probably shouldn't tell you this, but you need to prepare yourself for the fact that everyone on the show is a robot. So we wanted to hold the big reveal until the very end, but I kind of feel like you need to know now as you move forward.
Well, at least we got the scoop. I appreciate that.
And also, it was Parada's idea. Mr. Science.
Yes. It was a genius idea.
Whew. That's it. That is it. Can you believe that?
I can. And I feel like we just had the best jump start ever to get into season 3. You know, talking about senioritis and how this is the last season. This is like when you're pumped to go back to school. You've got the new backpack. You are off to a fresh start. You're ready to make your mark. And I feel like season 3 is going to make that mark on us, that this whole entire show is going to make a mark on people. And, you know, it is short. It's a 3-season show, and there's a small niche of us who watch this show, but I think it's going to be something that is going to grow even more so in the future.
Right. I think people will look back on this show kind of like the way they, this may not be a completely apt comparison, but it may end up being something kind of like Battlestar Galactica, mm-hmm. where, you know, it had its run. It was a relatively short run. BSG was 4 seasons, but
it had its niche audience at the time.
Had its niche audience. It may have been a fairly larger audience, but regardless, people have now since consumed it, and it has grown wildly because of things like Netflix or being able to go back and watch it. And I really feel like people will look at The Leftovers later on and say, why didn't I catch this show? And when they catch it and when they finally watch it on HBO Go, for example, mm-hmm. they're going to be like, oh, man, I missed out. I really missed out.
No, I wouldn't say I missed out. I would say I'm glad I found this.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I missed out. I'm glad I found this now.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to seeing what Damon and Tom have in store for us. And knowing that they treated each season kind of like its own novel. Like, you know, that they wrote the first season and they weren't even sure they were going to get a second season. And then they get the second season and they say, okay, well, if it ends right now, we're happy with this ending. What we did, having Kevin be with his whole extended family and everybody there and what happens to Miracle, that is a satisfying ending for us, mm-hmm. until they realize it wasn't. And then they get the third season.
You know, I really wanted to know what happened to these people during their departure, mm-hmm. when I first started. And it's been an unbelievable turn how through the second season, I don't care. I don't care what happened. And of course, they said, that is not the purpose of this show. You are not going to know what happened in the departure. Don't worry about it. Stop thinking about it. But I think that that's the journey we've gone on. It's not what happened, but how everything happened after that.
Right. What matters most is the people that are affected. We're with, that that we are with. And I like how they are unforgiving with the whole notion of we're not interested in telling you what happened to everybody that departed. And to be honest, I don't care. It doesn't matter because I haven't spent time with those people. I haven't gotten to know them. I would understand the allure for some people wanting to know what happened. But when you watch the show, you recognize it's not important. It is a supernatural event. It is what starts the show off. I will admit that.
I can't wait to read in the future, as more people learn about this and more people digest it, I can't wait to read the fan theories. Like, as many of you know, I'm a huge Harry Potter fan.
You're a wizard, Harry.
And one of the things that I love is when something pops up in my Facebook feed and they're like, what about this crazy theory that, like, Harry, because he was a Horcrux, that's why the Dursleys hated him, because Horcruxes make people mean and cranky and rude. And that is why the Dursleys treated him so badly, because Harry was a Horcrux. Total spoiler. So sorry if you haven't read it. It's your own fault. But it's made me as a Harry Potter fan go, oh my God, brilliant. Did J.K. Rowling think that? To be honest, probably not, because she, I don't think she's come out saying it. But what a brilliant idea. And I can't wait for fan theories like that after season three to come out and say, this is what happened during the departure. Mm-hmm. Or these are the types of people, or this is why, or just different ideas like that. For us just to geek out even more.
Yeah, the crowdsourcing behind it all. You know, I think that's fantastic. I love stuff like that.
Me too. So I don't need it now, but I'm going to need it in the years to come.
Well, my love, are you ready to begin the third season? Are you ready to podcast about it again? You get into the whole gamut and...
This show makes me get so deep. Yes.
I'm ready for it too. I'm so excited. But for now, we have to close out this very special episode. And a very big thanks to Damon and Tom and the people of HBO for allowing this episode. And also a good friend of mine, Brian Davids of the Film Schlubs podcast. He helped us make all of these questions and helped craft them and spent a lot of time with me to get the absolute right thing for you guys, the listeners, to make sure that you got the best experience. So, my love, ready to close out?
Yes.
All right. I kind of don't want to close it out. I'm living in my glory.
Well, I'm living in the fact that season three is about to start. So press that button.
All right, let's do it.
You could find us on all sorts of different social media, Twitter, Instagram, but really the best way to find us is Facebook right now. Let's be real. Everyone's on Facebook. During the show, when it's airing, we want you to tweet us your reactions after the episode. Mm-hmm. Our hashtag, I would just say, like, tweet at us with the @livingreminders. That is the best way. We will also always put up a picture on Instagram and on Facebook. So however you communicate on social media, we're going to want your feedback after each episode as soon as you can. Tell us your theories. You know, tell us those theories that we were talking about that are going to make me go wild. Tell us about how it made you feel, your personal connections with it, what you thought about Max Richter's haunting scores, because let's be real, this is its own character in and of itself. So find us on social media. You can find us with the handle Living Reminders.
And also during the season, on the Monday after the episode airs, we will be broadcasting our episode that we do normally every week right after the episode on Monday at, I'd say, 8 p.m. on Facebook Live. So if you wanted to join us on Facebook Live, you could do so and interact with us there. You can send us the tweets, or you could send us the voicemails at 503-454-6730 and get your voice heard on the final season of The Leftovers.
How can they email us?
At livingreminders@gmail.com.
Guys, hold on to your butts.
You know, I have a sound for that too.
I know you do, because I love that phrase.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
That's what I feel like. We're about to enter those big gates, man, into the unknown It's going to be some scary, crazy stuff. It's going to make your mind say, what?
Right.
Like, you just know it's coming. You just know it's coming, and it's coming hard. Season 3, let's do it.
All right, my love. I think that's it.
For now, ladies and gents, my name is Mary Larson.
I'm Blake.
And you've been listening to The Living Reminders.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.